LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Build an ability to just be yourself and not be doing something. That's what the phones are taking away.
Yes.
Is the ability to just sit there like this. That's being a person, right?
Yes.
No one can, they gotta, you gotta check. Because, you know, underneath everything in your life, there's that thing, that empty, forever empty. You know what I'm talking about? That.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I.
Yes.
Yes,
just
I know
that,
what you're talking
about. Knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone.
Comedian Louis C.K. talking to Conan O'Brien about our inability to disconnect. Coming up, an internet pioneer quit his connectivity addiction cold turkey. And why now, this toxic election season, why now may be the time for you to do the same. But first, just hours ago, the suspect connected with bombings in the New York City area this weekend was captured in Linden, New Jersey, after a shootout with police. 28-year-old Ahmed Khan Rahami was shot by police, according to Union County Acting Prosecutor Grace Park. Two police officers were also wounded.
They did exchange gunfire. One officer was struck in the abdomen, but into his bulletproof vest. The other had some glass that struck his forehead, but not into his skull. So we're really grateful that the Linden police officers who confronted Rahami are not in critical condition at all.
The first bomb connected to Rahami exploded in a garbage can in Seaside Park, New Jersey, near a Marine Corps charity run on Saturday. Later that evening, a bomb exploded in the Chelsea neighborhood of New York City, wounding 29 people slightly. Several other bombs connected to Rahami were found both in New York City and New Jersey. And here to fill us in on the latest is Dan Good. He's an editor at the New York Daily News. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Well, where was Rahami apprehended?
He was apprehended in Linden, New Jersey. It's about 11 o'clock local time. There had been a search all over the area, New York and New Jersey, for this guy. And, you know, you start hearing word of a shootout with police and a suspect in Linden. And he actually had been living in Elizabeth, which is pretty close. It just, you know, difficult to see all of the pieces being put together on what exactly happened.
Yeah, so it was 11 o'clock this morning when police arrested him or engaged in the shootout with him?
Yeah, there was a shootout. He was evidently at a bar, at or around a bar, and police found this guy and, you know, started recognizing him and saw that this was the guy that they had been looking for from surveillance images and mugshots. So there was a shootout that occurred, and, you know, as police or authorities have said that, you know, he was firing back at the cops. One of the officers was struck in the vest. The other got hit by some shrapnel or something. They were able to shoot him and, you know, take him into custody, and he's currently at the hospital.
And he's expected to pull through?
I guess, as far as I can tell, it seems like he will. He seemed to be responsive at the scene from what we were seeing from video and images when he was, you know, taken away and put into an ambulance.
And police suspect that he is behind the two bombings and then some other unexploded devices. Can you just go through exactly what authorities suspect him of doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you look at the types of bombs that were used in New Jersey and New York, and originally they weren't believing that they were connected because of the fact that they were different. Some were pipe bombs, some were pressure cooker devices. It really started on Saturday with, in Seaside Heights, New Jersey, there was a pipe bomb that went off in some sort of garbage can near like a charity, you know, charity run. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty tense. But that kind of stood out. And then the Chelsea bombing happened explosion happened on Saturday night, where there was a pressure cooker device, believed to be a pressure cooker device, that detonated, another one nearby that didn't. And evidently from that device that didn't detonate, they were able to pull a cell phone, and I believe that authorities used that cell phone to be able to connect him, you know, track him down, but also connect him to some of these other situations. But there were other devices that were found in New Jersey, one of which detonated overnight early this morning. So it's just scary, you know, given such a heavily populated area, given that it's a heavily transportation area, to have, you know, all these different devices around, and no one's exactly sure where they are and, you know, what their makeup is.
Yeah, and it's amazing that people weren't more seriously injured. Two guys found a backpack with, I guess, five devices in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and they picked it up. They picked up the backpack. That it could have exploded, I guess, when they picked it up, but it didn't.
Yeah, it really could have, and it's really scary to think of the death toll that could have been on a situation like this. Evidently, some homeless people may have found one of the bags carrying some of the bombs. So it's really scary to look at what could have happened, even, you know, amid 29 people being injured.
So it's still early on, but do we know anything about Rahami? We know he's from Afghanistan and moved here with his family.
Correct.
What more do we know about him and his family?
Yeah, he was born in Afghanistan. He was naturalized as a U.S. citizen. His family owns a chicken restaurant, and we're actually looking at that a little bit. The family had claimed that they were facing anti-Muslim harassment amid their running of the restaurant, and they sued the local government and police department. That case is suspended at this point. It hasn't gone forward. But it's really unclear what motivated this situation. It's unclear what may have inspired it. It's unclear. Authorities have gone back and forth as to whether there is any link to international terrorism, and it's really unclear at this point what, if any, link exists on that level, and how this all came together.
All right. Well, still early going, and I'm sure we'll find out a lot more as the day progresses. Dan Good, editor with the New York Daily News, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, events like the shootout and bombings in New York have had many of us glued to our screens, but so have cat videos and the presidential election, Emmy red carpet looks, the latest celebrity tweet. There's always something online to capture our attention. But at what cost? Author and internet pioneer Andrew Sullivan says it's the ultimate cost, being human. He wrote about his struggle to regain his humanity in the current issue of New York Magazine, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, you were an early adopter, as I said, a pioneer in this world. You were living online, pretty much, and making a nice living doing it. Just describe what your life was like when you were fully immersed. How many hours were you on the web?
Oh, I would say, you know, easily a majority of my waking hours, I was plugged in morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, and constantly assimilating all sorts of information, small, large, and trying to figure it all out as I went along with all the readers that were engaged in it. And it was in some ways just absolutely exhilarating, certainly to begin with. But over time, you just realize that something was really dragging your soul and mind downwards. And until I began to realize that all this distraction was actually just making me miserable and lonely and distant from people in ways that I didn't used to be.
Is that why you quit your blog?
Yeah. I mean, it was also just the sheer toll it takes on your body to be doing that for 15 years as I did. And I think it's a toll taken on all of us. It's the extra pressure and stress of running around, clicking that link, answering that email, answering that text. All this all day long has made us crazy. You can see it on the street. You can see how nobody even puts these things down anymore. You're even walking into walls with this stuff. And at some point, I kind of realized I'd like to live like a normal human being again, like we always used to, in which we actually talk face-to-face and have time down from our lives and some quiet moments and some reflective moments.
So you go on this retreat, you take an extreme break, you go on a meditative retreat where you have a vow of silence, you can't speak for days.
Or here. I mean, no one talks to you either. I went into this radical detox. I mean, at the end of about 9 months of trying to get my brain back in order, I mean, I forgot even how to read a book after all those years of jumping around links. And then took a deep dive. I thought it would be the ultimate way to learn what it's like on the other side of this experience, to actually be without any access to the web, to be forced without it, and then also without access to other people even, to kind of really plumb the depths of what it is like to be alone on this planet without this noise. And it was both extremely grueling, I have to say. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody but the desperate or for the not faint-hearted. But at the same time, very revelatory about the things that we actually are deep down in our psyches dealing with, that we push to the margins, and that this constant distraction actually keeps us from living fully our lives, understanding ourselves, and getting any kind of perspective on our lives. Because every little nook and cranny of spare time that we have is filled up with this noise. Boredom, I think, for human beings is a gift. Boredom is the time, certainly when I was a kid and as you grow up, where you have to fill up the space in your life with your own imagination and your own inventions and your own encounter with the world. And if you're always doing it through another source, if you're only doing it through online games or online texts or your Facebook feed or whatever, you're not really living. And being bored, like being sad, as Louis C.K. pointed out, are kind of critical parts of our being. And we think we're solving a problem. We're not. We're just compounding another kind of problem. And I think it makes us lonelier long run.
Well, there is a contradiction here in what you're saying, and that is we feel like we're connecting when we're online. We're connecting with other people. Maybe we're texting a friend, or we're connecting with a larger community by reading about what's happening elsewhere. And I think that's what we're all yearning for, is that sense of connection. But you're saying that going into this extreme detox to this place where you are actually not physically connecting with anyone provided you with a stronger sense of connection?
Yes. I was surrounded by other meditators who were much more experienced than I was. And just being around people whose lives had calmed down, who were quiet and open to experience, made me feel less alone. In a weird way, I think allowing oneself to be lonely or alone at times enables us to actually fully appreciate the company and interaction of others. And when we only have this interaction and no time down from it, we lose perspective on it. And that's the thing, you know, we think we're in contact with all these different people, and we are at some level, but only really a little part of us is. Like, we're not actually, remember when you used to actually make an actual phone call and talk to somebody as opposed to texting them? By texting someone, you keep them in their place. You keep a little limit on them. You keep a limit to your interaction with them.
Yeah.
You're not vulnerable to those people, and they're not vulnerable to you. And so the actual real connection, friendship, or even just the connection of people in the same town, that they look one another in the eyes, in the streets, that's disappearing in favor of this constant wired pseudo-connection. We think we're connecting, but we're not really. If you're friends with 300 people, you're really not friends with them. That's what I'm trying to say. You think you have an illusion of interaction and friendship and connection, and you actually don't.
Well, there's also this issue of time. And so sometimes we feel, well, we don't really have time to engage in a full long conversation because we know that it's going to take, well, at least 10 minutes and 20, maybe 30. Oh, my gosh. So much easier to do a couple texts, feel like you're connected, make that connection to somebody and say, OK, I've ticked that off my list and I'm keeping the friendship alive in some way.
Yeah, but you're not really. In fact, what you're saying is this friendship isn't worth my time. And time is the greatest gift we have for one another. That being with each other in real time, often physically together, is what makes our lives worth living. When we file all our friendships and social contacts under a file called efficiency, how many can we fit in a day, then we're actually showing a certain amount of contempt for those friends. We're treating them as a kind of online avatar, a contact in your book, in your voicemail list. That's what they become, not human beings, but contacts. not actual friends, but quote-unquote friends, you know, who you can mm-hmm. unfriend if they say something about Donald Trump you don't like. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's a way in which we're spread so thin across so many ways that we've forgotten actually what it is to really build a solid human relationship with one another.
So you came back from your retreat and you threw away your iPhone. You're no longer online.
Not quite. No.
What happened?
Well, I tried hard. But, you know, you live in the modern world. You're with people. They're all on Facebook. You have to communicate. You also want to know, you know, when we have this epic election going on, what's really happening. And so I do my half-hour meditation today. I did it just before we spoke, actually. And I try and walk and read books and be with people and cut this down. But to tell you the truth, no, I lapsed back, too. I'm not writing this piece from a position of any sort of superiority. I'm as completely besieged by this. So what I'm trying to argue is that we can maybe get better strategies to keeping this from taking over everything. In other words, just switch your notifications off on your phone. Give yourself a 24-hour, like, weekly digital Sabbath where you don't actually get into this information overload. You know, try meditation. Try exercise. Try making that phone call as opposed to that text and reconnecting with people. I think we're in danger of this new toy slowly making us less human, and we have to, as a species, adjust. And we can adjust, and I wish I could say I was optimistic, but I'm hopeful that we can do something to regain some kind of perspective and spirituality and calm.
I do have to say that I discovered your article online, and had I not been online cruising around, I would not have discovered it. We would not be having this conversation now. So for that, I'm grateful.
Well, that's the joy of it, too, of course, and that's why I love it. And I the article is not, I hope, an attack upon the Internet, because I love the Internet. It's an amazing thing. The article is about how we, 10 years after the iPhone and the smartphone gave us this 24 hours a day, how do we manage it better? How do we understand what it's doing to us, and how can we make sure it doesn't hurt us more than it is? And I think that's what I'm arguing for balance. And I think we're actually out of balance right now and need to find a way to get back to it.
Andrew Sullivan, thanks for coming on and having a real conversation.
You're fine. I'm going to do a Twitter chat about this tomorrow.
Excellent.
There are sort of crazy paradoxes and ironies here. But I think we can get through it somehow.
Balance. Andrew Sullivan, contributing editor to New York Magazine, where you can read his latest essay on the Internet. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you so much.
All right. We want to hear from you. What are you doing to manage this addiction? Have you had to disconnect to preserve your relationships or your personal mental health? We want to hear from you. Don't go online. Give us a call at 1-800-PRESS-PLAY. No, you can go online. We're on Twitter and Facebook. Let's be realistic here. But then you get off. All right. All right, do that at KCRW. Press play. Coming up, how California found itself on the hook for billions of dollars a year in pensions, and why even the governor who approved the plan, signed the bill into law, says he regrets doing that. That's next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 1999, former Governor Gray Davis signed SB 400 into law. And just like that, prison guards, park rangers, the highway patrol, and other state workers were suddenly entitled to the kind of pensions most of us can only dream about. For instance, some CHP officers can retire at age 50 and still make more than $96,000 a year for the rest of their lives. Proponents of the bill said it would not cost taxpayers a penny. But they were wrong. Those pensions will cost California taxpayers $5.4 billion this year, which is more than the state will spend on the drought, on emergency response, on fighting wildfires, more than all that combined. Jack Dolan has been investigating the story for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Why was this state employee pension deal made in the first place?
Well, you have to go back to the late 1990s. It was the dot-com bubble. If you were invested in the stock market, it felt like money was raining out of the sky. And the California pension fund, the giant pension fund for state employees, actually had more money than they figured they would ever need. They had tens of billions of dollars extra. So instead of saving that money for a rainy day in case there was a bump in the market, they decided to lavishly increase the retirement benefits for public employees. They decided that all state employees should be able to retire by 55 with more than half of their salary for the rest of their life and medical coverage for the rest of their life. If you were a highway patrolman, as you said, you could retire at 50 with basically 90% of your salary for the rest of your life and health care. And at the time, they said, look, the stock market has been so good, and we expect it to keep going. Investment gains will cover all of this.
So basically, these employees, they contribute to their pensions, right? And then CalPERS, the pension fund, that they invested for them in the stock market. And then they thought, okay, we're going to take that money and reap these great benefits, and it won't cost the state anything.
Correct. And it's worth noting that, you know, currently state employees will contribute between 5 and 11% of their salary. The match they get from their employer is 24%. I mean, my match from my employer is 3%.
Yeah.
So it's a stark difference to anyone in the public sector.
Right. Well, what did they think? They thought it would just go up and up and up. They didn't look at the history of the stock market and see that it goes down as well.
Well, as always in these stories, there was one lone voice, and that lone voice belonged to a guy named Ron Sealing. He was the chief actuary of CalPERS. And, you know, he was asked, shouldn't we figure out what the worst case scenario would be? And he predicted that if, you know, at the time they were thinking, well, we'll get about 8.25% return on our money, which is aggressive and bold. And he said, if we get just, you know, not a little bit more than half of that, in his words, it would be, quote, fairly catastrophic. And that was prophetic because, as soon as Gray Davis signed that bill, the next year, the stock market started to drop. The dot-com bubble burst. That went on for 3 years, and we were already getting pretty dangerously behind on the money we had salted away for these big pensions. And then, of course, in 2008, the housing market collapsed and the Great Recession kicked in, wiping out about a third of the value of the investments, which put the state in this horrendous hole that even though it's just pouring money into now, it can't fill.
But why is that when the stock market has rebounded?
Well, think of it this way. When you make a pension promise, it's like, okay, here's a stack of money we're setting aside and we're going to build on it through the years. And then next to it is a stack of IOUs from, you know, your future retirees. And as long as the stack of money grows faster than the stack of IOUs, you're good. But if the stack of money stops growing or, God forbid, shrinks, right, the stack of IOUs just keeps piling up and piling up relentlessly because as people are reaching those new early retirement ages, they're heading for the door with their new, much richer pensions, you have a significant problem.
Why so early? Why did they agree to give them this money at age 50 and 55?
Because the vast majority of the people making that decision were state employees themselves or representatives of state employees. And it just seemed like the natural and decent thing to do to them at the time.
Okay, so we are on the hook the taxpayers are on the hook this year for $5.4 billion, right?
Correct.
But the budget itself is $171 billion, so that's only about 3%.
There's a lot of ways you can cook that budget number. That is the most optimistic way of doing it. But The problem isn't just for the state. The problem, as soon as state employees got these rich formulas, cities and towns across the state started advocating, saying, well, you know, if it's good enough for the California Highway Patrol to retire at 50, it's good enough for, you know, this local police department or these local firefighters or prison guards. So you have cities and towns across the state where the pension hit is more like 20% of the annual budget of the city. That's the case in Los Angeles. Mm.
With the police and the firefighters here?
With all employees.
All public employees. Is there any way to undo this? This is a law now, but can it be undone?
Well, that's the trick. Under existing California state law, you can't, once you've promised somebody a pension benefit, you can't take it away. Even, you know, like if you're a 30-year-old employee and you've been promised it, you get to have that for the length of your career. Now, there has been a couple of decisions in courts that go against that, and it's likely to end up a state Supreme Court fight in the near future. But what cities and towns and the state itself have done is they say, okay, all new employees will reduce the pension benefits for them. But of course, you know, the taxpayers don't see the benefit of that for 30 years, right, until the new employees retire.
Well, you know, to take the other side, what's wrong with having a healthy pension? You know, these are workers who have put in their time. And why lower everyone's pension to really low levels, the low levels that some private sector employees may have to live on, maybe just Social Security benefits, which is not that much. Yeah. Why not raise everyone's boat? You know, it's not
right, no.
That and much money, $90,000 a year to live on, really.
Are you going to have that in retirement?
Well, I don't know. But you should
run the numbers, Madeline, because I think what you'll find is not. I mean, that was my initial response. You know, when I was asked to look into the story and I was told that public employees have great retirements, I thought, wonderful. I mean, who wants people to be poor in retirement? Right. Certainly not me. But here's the stark fact: to get $90,000 a year in retirement, you would need in your 401k, which is what most of us have, more than $2.5 million at the time you retire.
I'm definitely not getting $90,000.
No, the national average is $110,000, and that's for people who have some savings. Like a third of us don't have any savings, so $110,000, that'll get you like $4,000 a year. So the reason it's a problem is that the people who are supporting these wonderful pensions have nothing like it, and that's where the unfairness is.
Jack Dolan, investigative reporter at the LA Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, taking pictures of the people and places in Los Angeles that don't often get photographed.
If they were walking, they would have a different experience of LA, whatever parts of LA they live. But because a lot of people don't walk, they don't experience LA that way.
Photographer Anthony Hernandez is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The photographer Anthony Hernandez has traveled the world with his camera, but he has always returned to Los Angeles. His work is based in what he saw and experienced growing up in East LA and Boyle Heights, the kid of Mexican immigrants. A lot of his work could be described as street photography, capturing the hard faces and hard lives of a gritty Los Angeles. But there are also landscapes featuring tire shops and abstract photos of contemporary ruins. He captures poetry in an environment that most people would consider urban blight. After a career spanning more than 45 years, San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art will hold its first retrospective of Hernandez's work. It opens this weekend, and he's here to talk about it. Hi there, Anthony Hernandez. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, you grew up in Boyle Heights?
Yeah. Boyle Heights all my life.
Yeah. And what were your earliest photos? Did you take pictures of the neighborhood?
Actually, the very first, what I would call, which I've called my first gesture, was an automobile repair shop. Next to it was an empty lot, which they used to throw their odd parts of automobiles, whether it's a drivetrain or anything that was just discarded. That lot I used to pass by when I was walking from home from high school. And the first photographs I thought of trying to make, I tried to photograph these parts that were thrown on this empty lot. So those were the very first pictures that I ever made in 1965, 66. And sorry to say, somehow those negatives in a little prints were lost, and this was only taken with a little Hawkeye Brownie, camera that everybody had during that time.
What was so important about photographing those discards?
That I don't know. I haven't been able to figure it out, but I embraced it, and everything I've done since, going over street photographs and everything else I've photographed, things really started from that.
So you, throughout the decades, have taken pictures of discards, and you have taken pictures of, as I mentioned earlier, empty lots as well in your later photography. But also when you look at the people in your early photos, it seems to me that some of the people that you capture are the people who maybe society has discarded, and or maybe they feel discarded by society.
If you put it in context, where they are in terms of the city, and maybe that city has it has a weight for people that have to be in that particular space. And so the photographs maybe reflect that kind of environment where people are maybe uncomfortable, or it's difficult, or it's hard. And you have to remember, these are 35 millimeter black and white photographs that I made while I was actually walking through this space. So the photographs are actually made while I'm actually moving through, kind of like a dance through downtown LA and other cities. And that's the way it was, kind of a very fluid way of working. But it is a hard, when you think of cities, you know, in terms of a very urban place, it is a hard environment, and there's no doubt about it. And it hasn't, in other words, LA now is different than it was when I was there photographing, but it's still a difficult place to actually move through.
Yeah. So you didn't ask them to pose for you? You just caught them?
No. I'm photographing. So the camera is in my hand, and as I'm walking through and past people, then if I see something coming up to me that I want to photograph, then the camera comes up to my eye. And then I could click with one hand a picture, just with one hand. So you can't tell till you get your film back and look at it to say if you actually got that. And sometimes when that camera comes up to my eye, I won't take that picture because something happened, they moved, or it didn't work, or it didn't seem like it was going to work. So it's a constant kind of fluid way of working. Like I said, it's more like a dance to me. I always thought of it that way.
It's interesting because you describe it, one would think that the photographs themselves would be blurry or exhibit some kind of movement. But in fact, it's quite the opposite. They don't at all. They look very static.
And well, some that you didn't see them
I guess,
were that other way.
Right. But it seems like they were artfully composed. There's composition to them.
And, yes.
And you're saying that in a lot of these cases, it's just by chance that they turned out so well?
I mean, when I was photographing, I mean, obviously it was I was very focused, walking, looking, and photographing that way, and you get better and better at it after a period of time.
I want you to talk a little bit more about the people in your early work. I understand that you stopped doing a lot of the people-focused photographs in the 1980s, but your earlier work had a lot of people in them, and you photographed.
Yeah, I photographed from basically 66 all the way to 76 35 millimeter black and white photographs, and then the first body of work in color of 1984 of Rodeo Drive was the first color, but the last photographs of people. It wasn't a conscious decision to stop photographing people. It's just that it happened that I started photographing something else, and then I just never got back to photographing people. Though I've made a picture of somebody recently, which I haven't photographed in years, and the photograph is a man living in his bus, and it is in my show in San Francisco. It will be in the show, and it also is in the book that they published, and it's a very different kind of picture, but I'm very happy that I made that picture.
So what attracted you to take a picture of a person after so many years, and why that person?
That's a long story, but I'll cut it short. I was actually driving back from Texas, coming up through the Salton Sea, and I saw a very funky old bus along the side of the road, nobody around it, passed it. But then I turned around thinking, oh, that was an interesting bus because it had all this graffiti around it. It's an old school bus, and it had a big platform on top. So by the time I got back to the bus, the man that was living in that bus was coming around. He had been on the other side of it. I hadn't seen him, so I asked him if I could photograph his bus. He said, sure. And after I photographed his bus, meaning that I put my camera away and tripod and everything, I felt sorry for him, so I gave him $20. And he was so excited. He said, let me give you something. And I said, okay. But anyway, he shuffled back to his bus. And when he came out, standing on his steps, right in the bus, to give me this brochure, which was something he'd been mimeographed so many times he could barely read it, but basically it was saying, Jesus, this, and, you know, one of those kind of things. And I looked up at him and I said, do you mind if I take a picture of you if you don't move? And he said, sure. Well, I had rushed back to my car and set my camera up again, all over again with a tripod and everything, 4x5 view camera. I only had one holder left, meaning I only had two shots left. And I shot a picture of him. And that was one of these, I would call it, it's a very photographic moment. In other words, it came to me. Mm. It wasn't something I was planning on doing, but you just, when it happened, you recognized it and you took a picture.
So when you did the pictures of people back in the 70s and in the black and white pictures, often they're in downtown locations or neighborhoods in East LA. Maybe they're waiting for a bus or they're sitting on a park bench.
Right.
But they're often alone. And then you have a series of photographs on Rodeo Drive, and the clientele is a lot different. The people in it, I suppose they're a lot richer, it seems. But there seems to be some
color.
And it's in color, yeah. Well, right. But it seems like they're also similarly alone and similarly isolated and similarly unhappy, it seems. What were you trying to get at with these pictures of Rodeo Drive in the 80s?
When you really think about it, what the subject is really so ordinary, really ordinary, whether it's downtown LA or Beverly Hills. But it's the pictures that are not ordinary. And that's, you might say that's the challenge for me as an artist. And I think that's part of me, is that I think of it as a challenge. And all the other photographs as well, not just the photographs of people, it's a challenge to make something that the subject is so ordinary and the pictures are not.
And in the landscape photos, some of them have objects in them, and they look like discarded objects in some instances. Do you ever arrange any of the objects?
No.
There's one of, I think, 20 pennies lined up in a box in a square on the ground.
Yes.
And you just found them that way?
That print where those pennies were collected by a homeless young, well, not so young, black woman who was obviously mentally off in downtown L.A., on the edge of downtown L.A., and she was always near this bridge, and one day she wasn't there, and that's when I went in to try to see what I could photograph, and that's what I found. She arranged them that way, and if you notice, there's one penny. All of them are flat next to each other, a grid, except there's one penny that's on top of the other penny.
Mm-hmm.
So I always think of that as that's her last, is that the last one she put down, or is that the first one? I said, no, it's probably the last one. But it's almost as if you can feel her arranging those pennies.
Mm. Yeah, it's really beautiful. And now that you've told me the story, I can see how you've put the person back into this landscape. Because you said you stopped taking photographs of people, but the person is in that picture.
Yeah, a sense of pointing to touch. And it's difficult in terms of photographs, like when people look at a painting, a brush strokes of, you know, whether it's Vincent van Gogh, or you can name a number of different artists' paintings, that's a sense of touch. Well, I think of that as well, and can I do that in a photograph? And that's a big challenge.
You know, Los Angeles has been portrayed in so many movies and television shows and songs and images and on and on and on. Does that weigh on you, this idea of Los Angeles, the fact that we all carry images in our heads of Los Angeles that are manufactured, and that necessarily dictates how we view Los Angeles as we move through it?
Well, yeah, probably because people have the wrong images. And, you know, they don't realize there's a different L.A. out there. And a lot of it has to do with that people actually, if they were walking, you know, wherever they actually lived and did a lot of walking, they would have a different experience of L.A., whatever parts of L.A. they live. But because a lot of people don't walk, they don't experience L.A. that way, you know. And so I think that... it has a lot to do with it, you know. But in terms of the backdrop of L.A. and the film industry and television and all that, it's so surreal that and people living and driving in their cars, that they just, it's like the L.A. that they don't know, mm-hmm. you know. And I think for me, I haven't exhausted L.A. L.A.'s got, it's so rich in terms of subject matter. It just takes time.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's photographer Anthony Hernandez. The first retrospective of his work will open this weekend at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Jump.